Good day. Today is Saturday, 15th November 2025. And before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button if once you've watched and listened to the programme or whichever part of the programme you want to watch and listen to, you've liked what you've heard and you decide that you want to indicate that fact. Now, let me proceed with the programme. And again, today's programme will mostly be taken up with the situation in Ukraine. But before I discuss that, a very brief word. The President of the United States, Donald Trump, has now said that he has made a decision about what to do in relation to Venezuela. He said that he's not going to discuss or disclose what that decision is, but it's difficult to believe, at least I find it difficult to believe, that at this stage, after the deployment of these enormous forces, US forces, close to Venezuela, the President of the United States has not taken a decision to undertake some kind of military action. Perhaps, just possibly, he will precede that action by some kind of ultimatum to the Venezuelan government, perhaps a demand that President Maduro step down, or perhaps, as I suspect is equally likely, we will see simply an attack on headquarters, the leadership of Venezuela, centered on the city of Caracas itself, with an attempt to carry out a decapitation strike against the Venezuelan leadership. What happens thereafter, whether the United States conducts a ground operation, whether the Venezuelan military cracks under the pressure, whether there is a coup, or whether there is continued resistance and perhaps a rallying around President Maduro, all of that we will have to wait and see. Anyway, let me now turn to the far more important and far more consequential war. And I say that without any hesitation, because the conflict in Venezuela is not a proxy war between the United States and the BRICS states, China and Russia. And it is not a coalition war between, on the part of those states, against the United States. The Ukraine war emphatically is, and Ukraine, the war in Ukraine, is of course taking place on the eastern border of Europe. Of course, many people say that Ukraine is a part of Europe. So any military defeat in Ukraine is a military defeat of the West, of NATO, of the United States in a critically important region. One person who has in effect made exactly that point over the last few hours is Michael Flynn, General Michael Flynn, who was formerly the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency in President Obama's time, who was then briefly President Trump's national security advisor before he was brought down very unfairly and improperly, in my opinion, at the outset of the Russiagate scandal. Anyway, General Flynn, who I appreciate is controversial with some people, but nonetheless has a background as a US intelligence officer, a US very high-ranking military officer, and who has, if only for a short time, been President Trump's national security advisor, has now actually come out and said that the Ukraine war is lost by the United States, that everyone in the United States needs to recognize and acknowledge that fact, that the only thing that can be done now is to find some face-saving way to extricate the United States from a debacle which Flynn, who continues to be loyal to Donald Trump, says is ultimately former President Biden's doing. Now, that is going to be easier said than done at this point. The Russians have been making more statements recently about the state of negotiations between themselves and the Americans. Peskov, in particular, has been extremely busy. The Russians have gone out of their way to say, as they always do, in fact, one can almost say that this is now acquiring a kind of ritual character, these statements from the Russians, that they're prepared to engage in negotiations with the Americans, but only on the basis of what was agreed between Putin and Trump in Anchorage. And of course, when the Russians say that, they're basically signaling that Trump must return to the position that the Russians believed he had agreed to in Anchorage, which is in effect Istanbul plus. Thus, the acceptance of all Russian key demands relative to the conflict in Ukraine. And of course, the Russians know when they say that, that President Trump, after the meeting in Anchorage, as Foreign Minister Lavrov has carefully explained in a series of critically important interviews and press conferences, which I have discussed extensively on this channel. Anyway, as the Russians well know, as soon as the Anchorage meeting was ended, President Trump basically went back on whatever it was that the Russians believed he had agreed with them. So for President Trump to come back now to tell the Russians that, yes, he is indeed going to accept Istanbul plus the Russian demands, what he seemed to be close to accepting in Anchorage, would be a massive climb down by the president. It would be deeply humiliating. It might actually shake the president's authority at this stage with some people within his administration who might ask why it is that the president now is going back to what he first accepted with Putin and then seemed to walk back from and vehemently reject, why he's going back to it, and would it not have been better perhaps if the president had stuck to his original decision back in August to accept Istanbul plus, or alternatively, if you're someone with neocon views, perhaps the president now accepting Istanbul plus, going back to what he agreed with Putin back in Alaska, is a further sign of the president's weakness and of the supposedly unhealthy influence over him exerted by President Putin of Russia. So anyway, it would be deeply humiliating and very difficult for the president to do that. I have no doubt that that is exactly what he should be doing and should be doing now. But given how embarrassing and difficult it is, I think that a president, this president, who is perhaps acutely conscious of issues of faith, is unlikely to do it. So maybe, perhaps, that's one reason why he's now getting himself mixed up with the Venezuela business instead. Ultimately, bad, perhaps even though disastrous, I expect it eventually to be. Anyway, let's move on and discuss the situation in this extremely consequential war. Actually, before I do that, let me make a further quick point. The president and his officials ever since the president was inaugurated back in January, have taken to referring to the war in Ukraine as fully avoidable, with which I agree, but pointless. They also now, and increasingly I've noticed, refer to this war as pointless. It is not a pointless war. For the Russians, it is an existentially important war. For Ukraine, for the Zelensky government, for the Maidan movement, it is an existentially important war. For the Europeans, it is an existentially important war, or so they have persuaded themselves to think. Again, constantly harping on, as too many US officials now do, about the supposed pointlessness of this war, downplays its significance in ways that would make it, if the Americans stuck to that position, would make it impossible diplomatically to settle. I don't think that President Trump and some of his officials have ever really understood what this war is about. I've already said that the alleged, well, in fact, the undoubted impatience to deal with the history is a major weakness and probably explains, in fact, undoubtedly goes far to explain why, as the president says, this war has proved so much more difficult to settle than perhaps he initially thought. Anyway, let me move on and discuss what is going on in this very consequential war, which most emphatically does have a purpose and a point. So what is going on? Well, the last 24 hours, we've had more news now about that major Russian missile strike on Kiev that I talked about in my program yesterday. And from what I've been able to understand, this strike was indeed devastating and has further crippled the energy complex in Kiev itself. There are also reports that over the course of this attack, the Russians monitored the operation of Kiev's air defense system, of its Patriot missiles complexes that have recently gone into operation around Kiev, and that as soon as the strike on the energy system was underway, the Russians focused instead on destroying the Patriot missile systems. Now, I don't know whether that is true, and I don't know whether those Patriot missile systems were destroyed. But I have seen a report of certain comments that the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio is alleged to have made. For the record, I believe he did say them, though I have not had time to track them down. Anyway, according to these reports, the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio said that the life expectancy of a Patriot missile complex delivered to Ukraine has now fallen to about a week. A week. Now, given how few of these systems now exist, their enormous cost, the enormous cost of each Patriot missile interceptor, and the apparently unresolvable capacity problems, industrial problems, in producing more of them, if it is indeed the case that delivering Patriot missile systems to Ukraine guarantees their destruction over the course of a single week, then delivering more Patriot missile systems to Ukraine is not only irrational, it is in fact pure madness. They're not changing the situation on the battlefronts. They're simply depleting the American arsenal of these weapon systems at warp speed and clocking up costs for the United States and its allies, which are completely unjustifiable. I say that because apparently Friedrich Merz, the German Chancellor, who's now just managed to get his increasingly fractious coalition to agree to increase funding for Ukraine from 9 billion euros a year to 3 billion to 11 billion euros a year in 2026. Apparently, the additional 3 billion euros a year is intended to be used to buy mostly weapons, and of those, mostly air defense systems, in other words, Patriot systems. So it seems to me that Friedrich Merz, economic genius as he is, has just written out a check for 3 billion euros, which might just as well be torn up for all the actual effect it does. Well, it won't be torn up because, of course, the money will be transferred to Ukraine. And, well, all that money will be for absolutely nothing. Now, turning to the missile strike that the Russians conducted against Kiev, again, it was striking that the strike was conducted overwhelmingly with Iskander missiles, though some Kinzhal missiles were involved, and the Ukrainians also claimed that a single Tsarkon hypersonic cruise missile was launched against Kiev by Russian warships in the Black Sea. The Russians have admitted that from time to time, Tsarkon missiles have indeed been used against ground targets in Ukraine. I should say that this is a missile that travels at speeds of around 8 times the speed of sound. It's an incredible system, though I suspect that its warhead is probably smaller than that of the Kinzhal missile, which is a ballistic rocket. Anyway, the Russians have admitted that they do use these hypersonic cruise missiles against Ukraine from time to time, but they made it clear that this is done more by way of testing these cruise missiles, the Tsarkon missiles, rather than because they're actually needed and play any significant role in the air war. Now, the Ukrainians inevitably are making all sorts of claims this morning about how many missiles, Russian missiles, Iskander missiles, and Kinzhal missiles they shot down, and how many of the hundreds of Gerand drones also launched in this attack, allegedly over 400 of those. How many of those they shot down too? Now, in the previous attack, the Ukrainians basically admitted that they were unable to shoot down any Iskander missiles. But in this attack, as I discussed in my program yesterday, we saw flashes confirming that Patriot missile interceptors had indeed been put into operation. If the Ukrainians, after using Patriot missiles to try to repel this attack, had admitted that every Patriot missile had failed to shoot down a Russian ballistic or hypersonic missile, then that would, of course, reinforce skepticism in the West, most importantly in the United States, about the wisdom of supplying Patriot missile systems to Ukraine. So, of course, the Ukrainians don't do that. They don't want to undermine the appearance of effectiveness of the Patriot missiles. So they are claiming that they did this time manage to shoot down at least some of the missiles that were launched against them. I'm going to say straight away that I do not believe that a single incoming missile launched by the Russians was shot down. I think that the very extensive evidence of damage, of which there is now significant footage from across Kiev, speaks for itself. Now, one missile, Russian or Ukrainian, in other words, Patriot's missile, does appear to have done a small amount of damage to Azerbaijan's embassy in Kiev. And predictably, the Azerbaijanian government has complained vociferously about this to Moscow and is claiming that this was a Russian missile that impacted close to the embassy. The footage of the missile debris near the embassy, however, or so I understand, based on the views of those who know about such things, says the actual reality is that the missile that seems to have done this damage to the embassy was a Patriot missile which failed to shoot down a Russian target and which accordingly fell to earth. So there it is. It seems to me that we are now looking at the beginning of the end of Ukraine's ability to defend itself against Russian missiles. We see that every single day the Russian night offensive, missile offensive, the offensive in the air continues to grow in power and to escalate. And I noticed that though there were complaints from NATO and from Europe about these Russian attacks on Kiev, the President of the United States and his officials, who back in the summer, in the spring and summer, used to complain about these attacks, they are now silent. They now understand that there is nothing that they can do to prevent them and that they have no leverage over the Russians in relation to them. Now, as I also discussed in my program yesterday, the Ukrainians also carried out their own drone attack on Russia. And apparently they didn't just use drones, they used missiles too. Neptune missiles, anti-ship missiles, an anti-ship missile developed by Ukraine on the basis of the Soviet Kh-35 missile, which the Russians have also kept in production and are still updating. It was the Soviet equivalent of the Harpoon, the American Harpoon missile, and it continues to equip some Russian warships, just saying, and Russian coastal defense batteries as well. Anyway, the Ukrainians have shown footage of what they say is a missile launcher launching these Neptune missiles at Russia as part of this attack. I doubt that these missiles actually have the range to reach Russia from any part of Ukrainian-controlled territory anymore. Perhaps they were trying to target places closer to Crimea or who knows where. And again, there are the rumours that Ukraine also launched a few of Vladimir Zelensky's much-touted Flamingo cruise missiles. Well, trying to work out, or for me to say, what the exact breakdown in terms of drones and missiles of the Ukrainian attack was would be very difficult. But all the indications are not just from what the Russian Defense Ministry is saying, but from the visible effects of this strike on the ground, that it was unsuccessful. Hundreds of drones and perhaps a dozen missiles were launched, and apart from a fire at the Russian port of Novorossiysk on the Black Sea, perhaps caused by a Neptune missile, no actual significant damage was caused. It seems that a cluster of Ukrainian drones was brought down by the Russian air defense system in Saratov region, which strongly suggests that the target again was Russia's Engels air base, which is the air base, one of the air bases used by Russia's strategic forces. But the drones never got to Engels, and this seems to have been true of the vast majority of drones that Ukraine launched over the course of that night. So we see the difference again. We see that these Ukrainian attacks come nowhere close to matching the vastly greater effectiveness of the Russian attacks. Now, as it happens, last night the Russians attacked Ukraine again from the sky. This time they attacked, perhaps with Kinjal missiles, at least reports say, with Kinjal missiles, the great Soviet airbase now in central Ukraine at Starokonstantinov. This is the base where reputedly many of the F-16s and Mirage 2000s that now make up the core of Ukraine's air force are located. Again, how much actual damage was done, what the strike achieved, well, we'll just have to wait and see what the Russian Defense Ministry says. In my opinion, these Ukrainian drone attacks and missile attacks on the Russians are completely counterproductive. I have noticed that the story about gasoline shortages across Russia, about problems about the, caused supposedly by the problem, the attacks, the Ukrainian attacks on the Russian oil refineries, it seems that that story has basically melted away. And that's not surprising because, and for the record, there are no gasoline shortages at present in Russia. So the attempt to disable Russia's energy complex, which is far too ambitious, has apparently been abandoned. It's not clear to me what the purpose of these Ukrainian drone attacks actually is anymore, other than perhaps, again, the PR objective of giving the impression that the Ukrainians are still in the fight somehow. What these Ukrainian drone attacks do, all that they do, is that they give the Russians a pretext to launch their far more powerful and far deadlier attacks on Ukraine. And, well, probably the Russians would be doing that anyway, because as I've discussed in many places, they're clearly working to a plan. But I still don't understand why Ukraine would go to the excuse of the excuse would go to the lengths of providing the Russians with the excuse to do so. Anyway, there it is. That's the war in the sky. We'll be hearing no doubt more over the next couple of hours. There are rumours that another big Russian strike is on the way, quite possibly. Bear in mind that the latest big strike took place just 10 days after the last one. So we can see that the pace is accelerating, that there is every day now a strike of some kind by the Russians, that the Garand drones operate over Ukraine's airspace every night, but even the pace of the missile strikes is accelerating. And by the way, I also read a report. Again, it's difficult to know where this report, which I believe comes from an American source, it'd be interesting to know where this American source gets its information. But this report claimed that the Russians are now producing 120,000 precision-guided fab bombs each year now. That in 2025, they have set themselves the target to produce 120,000 of these massive and extremely powerful and now precision-guided and in some cases jet-powered or jet-enhanced bombs. And now, somebody calculated that that means that the Russians could drop around 300 of these bombs each day. And well, there's been a lot of discussion and commentary about the artillery war, and there are occasional claims that the Russians are now outshelling the Ukrainians by a ratio of just 2 to 1, when of course it's been significantly more than that at earlier points in the war, and that the level of shelling altogether has fallen. I think it is probably true that there is significantly less shelling than there was in 2022 and at times in 2023. I still believe that the Russians are shelling Ukraine heavily, and the word I got is that the Russian shelling level is at around 20,000 rounds a day, which is what Sirski said earlier this year. Just saying. But I do accept that it is likely that the Russians are shelling a lot less than they were shelling earlier in the war, when perhaps they were shelling, firing around 40,000 plus shells against Ukraine a day. And this, of course, does undoubtedly involve industrial constraints on the Russian side also. Maintaining shell firing rates of 40,000 shells a day would require production rates of shells into the many millions. And one can understand why the Russians might not be able to sustain that indefinitely. But a point which many people, I think, don't make is that from a Russian point of view, if you can drop immeasurably more powerful shells with far bigger and more powerful warheads, sorry, bombs rather, drop bombs with far more powerful warheads than any shell. And if you now have hundreds of bombs that you can drop each day, 300 according to these claims, then you don't need shells so much anymore. Obviously, the Russian drones are also playing their part, but I suspect that the greatest destruction, and by the way, the greatest killing, is probably now being done by the bombs. And this is an understated story in this war. Russian bombing in Ukraine has now achieved comparable levels to what the United States routinely conducts in many of its wars. And through precision-guided guidance, these bombs appear to be at least as effective and as precise as American bombs. And Russian bombs overall appear to be bigger and more powerful than the American bombs are. Anyway, that's the situation in the sky. And we can see that the situation is becoming worse for Ukraine every night and every day. But what about the situation on the front lines? And let me now again do one of my brief, relatively brief summaries about the situation there. Firstly, there is considerable deluge of information coming from what you might call the Zaporozhye Dnipropetrovsk front lines. Apparently, the Russians have now confirmed that they've captured the village of Yablukovo, which is located to the northeast of the town of Guliapolye. In fact, they appear to be capturing various other villages in this area as well. The Russians now have nothing, as I discussed in my program yesterday, between their frontal positions northeast of Guliapolye and Guliapolye itself. The Russians, having captured some days ago the village of Danilovka on the main supply road to Guliapolye from the north, are now advancing south of that road, clearing the Ukrainian positions on the east side, on the west side of that road, bringing about the full encirclement of Guliapolye closer. The Russians further north have captured a village called Alexandropil, which in itself perhaps is not a particularly important place, but it opens the way for the capture of the much bigger adjoining village of Velikomikhailovka, which is a much more important place. And there are even reports that the Russians are now fighting inside this village of Velikomikhailovka as well. And further north still, but still in the Dnipropetrovsk region, the Russians are now said to have captured around two-thirds of the village, or perhaps more accurately, small town of Novopavlovka, which used to be a heavily fortified position of the Ukrainians and which used to be an important logistics base. And it looks as if the Russians are rapidly capturing it. The dissident Ukrainian MP, Mariana Bezuglaya, has written another of her bitter and angry statements. She says that the town of Guliapolye is lost, and she is now openly blaming Zelensky and saying that part of the blame for this is Zelensky's insistence on clinging on to Sirski. And by the way, just on my part to add to that, Sirski's insistence on clinging on to the general, the Ukrainian general in overall charge in this area, who is, of course, the serially unsuccessful General Tarnavsky. Anyway, Guliapolye is a place which has played a significant role in Russian history. After the Russian Revolution, Russia went through a civil war. The town of Guliapolye became the headquarters of a anarchist fighter called Nestor Makhno, who's quite well known in Russian and Ukrainian history. Makhno was successful in mobilizing local Cossacks and peasants into a kind of anarchist community in Zaporozhye region, in this region of Zaporozhye region, no doubt building on the somewhat anarchic traditions of the local Cossacks. And anyway, he is a big name in the history of the Russian Revolution to those who know it well, and he's a big name in both Russia and Ukraine, and Guliapolye was, in effect, his base. So it has this storied history, but it is in itself a relatively small place. Its pre-war population was around 12,000. So that puts it at about the same level as Siversk and Ugledar, and significantly smaller than, say, Avdeyevka or Liman, or of course Pokrovsk, Bakhmut, Severodonetsk, Lysychansk, any one of these places. So if the Russians do manage to break into Gallipoli, then it's difficult to see, especially given how Gallipoli is already almost surrounded. The Russians have been located to the south of Gallipoli actually for years. So, I mean, they established their positions there back in 2022. So the town is already mostly surrounded. The supply lines, as we've seen, are being cut. It's difficult to imagine that Gallipoli, the garrison at Gallipoli, would be able to resist for very long. It will soon be submerged in the tidal wave, which is the Russian army pressing west. And perhaps even the Ukrainian command understands this, as I said, Mariana Bezuglaya does. There are now reports that the Ukrainian authorities are calling on the civilian population of Gallipoli to leave, to evacuate the town, which is soon going to become a battle zone. I am going to make a guess that the Battle of Gallipoli, once it begins, is not going to be a very long one. Anyway, there is a view, is articulated by Dima on the Military Summary Channel, that the ultimate objective of the Russians, the immediate objective of the Russians, is not the city of Zaporozhye itself or the city of Dnipro, but the city of Pavlograd, which lies midway between the existing Russian positions and the Dnieper River. Pavlograd has a population of, I believe, around 100,000 people, so it's a biggish place. And it is also a major communications and supply hub. Briefly, the supplies from the west and from Ukraine, western and central Ukraine, cross the river, the Dnieper in Zaporozhye and Dnipro. They're then sent by road or rail to Pavlograd, and from Pavlograd, they are distributed across eastern Ukraine. And when I say eastern Ukraine, I mean even places well to the north, like Kharkiv city itself. So capturing Pavlograd would supposedly enable the Russians to cut almost completely the supply lines to all Ukrainian forces, not just in Donbass, but across the whole of eastern Ukraine, even Kharkiv itself. Well, perhaps that's right. I mean, I am not privy, as I said many times, to the Russian General Staff's plans, though I have no doubt that they do have plans. I would be surprised if Pavlograd does not feature pretty high on those plans. And it is the case that the Russians have now crossed the greater distance from their original starting positions to Pavlograd. So Pavlograd is, if you like, within sight. And it is also true that it's mostly open country after Novopavlivka and Velikomikhailovka towards Pavlograd. And especially if Pokrovsk falls, large forces, Russian forces, would presumably be released to advance westwards towards Pavlograd as well. So, you know, maybe this is the Russian plan. But I still myself sense that the major priority for the Russians, and where they will commit a significant number of their forces to, after the fall of Pokrovsk will be to breaking the defense line, the Ukrainian defense line in Donbass, to capturing first Konstantinivka, where fighting is underway, and then when Kupiansk, Liman, Pokrovsk, and all of these other places fall, capturing the two important towns of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, which I suspect will at that point anyway also be mostly undefendable. Now, as to that, we've had quite a lot of information from Pokrovsk. Firstly, yesterday, after I did my program, the Russian Defense Ministry confirmed that the village of Rog, which lies just west of Pokrovsk, north of the village of Gnatovka, which the Russians captured about 2 days ago, that Rog has also fallen. There's also video footage and claims and hints from the Russian Defense Ministry that the whole of southern Mirnograd is about to fall. But perhaps the most interesting information, at least for me, came from the Russian Defense Ministry this morning. They said this morning that an operation has now begun to clear the village of Rivne. Rivne is a village that lies between Mirnograd and Pokrovsk. It's closer to Pokrovsk, and it is part of the belt of built-up territory that lies between Pokrovsk and Mirnograd. If the Russians capture Rivne, then, well, they will be very close to attacking Mirnograd also from the west, and they will have severed the remaining connections between Pokrovsk and Mirnograd itself, further isolating the Ukrainian troops there. Now, other Russian commentators have spoken about the situation of the Ukrainians in Mirnograd. Our old friend Andrei Marochno had this to say to TASS: the cauldron near Mirnograd has practically been sealed shut. There is a tiny section along Verbitsky Street, which is already in the grey zone. In other words, it's contested. Overall, I can say that the Ukrainian group is completely encircled. Ukrainian soldiers still have a choice to surrender voluntarily now and lay down their arms, or to remain in Mirnograd forever and be destroyed by our troops. Pretty chilling stuff, but I suspect it's true. And, well, that's what one Russian has said, and that's Marochko. I believe that Pokrovsk, the urban area of Pokrovsk, is now firmly under Russian control. And this advance towards Rivne, which does close even theoretical options for the Ukrainians to escape from Mirnograd once Rivne is captured. Well, at that point, I'm really not sure what the Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd can do. Now, that doesn't appear to be the opinion of General Sirski, because he again has been in this very same area. He again speaks of the Ukrainians successfully holding their positions in Pokrovsk, as well as Mirnograd. He says that the Russians are trying to consolidate their positions in Pokrovsk, and that what the Ukrainians have to do is to prevent the Russians from doing that, and that this is somehow still an achievable objective. I have to say this, to me, this looks like a cynical exercise in deceiving the Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd, of getting them to fight on and to refuse Russian offers of surrender on the basis that the Ukrainian 7th Cavalry are on the way, and that if the Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd hold on for just a little longer, rescue will come. Now, the Russian Defense Ministry this morning has again spoken of Ukrainian attempts to try to break the ring around the encircled Ukrainian troops. But I would say in Mirnograd now, as opposed to Pokrovsk. And again, these attacks appear to have come from the village of Gryshino to the west. We've actually had video footage of one of these attacks. A small group of Ukrainian soldiers who tried to enter northeast Pokrovsk through a forested area, who were then tracked by Russian drones, and who appear to have been, well, destroyed when they entered a building on the northern outskirts of Pokrovsk. So these attacks do continue. But overall, to me, this looks like a cynical exercise in deception to keep the fight in Mirnograd going for as long as possible. If we actually go to the situation north of Mirnograd, the latest reports all say that the position of the Ukrainians there has deteriorated. So supposedly, and this is according to Ukrainian reports, Russian counterattacks in Rodinska mean that that town is once again fully under Russian control. And the Ukrainians themselves admit that the two villages of Vladimirovka and Shakhovo, especially Shakhovo, which is an especially important place, have now been abandoned fully by the Ukrainians, and the Russians are in the process of occupying them. Now, if this is all true, and it comes from Ukrainian sources, and I'm confident that it is true, then even the theoretical possibility of a Ukrainian breakthrough to Mirnograd has gone. The Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd are conclusively and completely trapped. The only humane thing for Zelensky and Syrsky to do is to order their surrender. Yesterday, I said that Zelensky, when speaking about how decisions about whether to defend Pokrovsk or not would be made by the military, and that he would not stand in the way. I said that yesterday, and I said that that probably meant that he's now reconciled, accepted the reality of the loss of Pokrovsk. Well, I suspect that part of the reason he did that is because he knows that with the Ukrainian troops now trapped deep inside the cauldron, inside Mirnograd, there is really no escape for them, and that there is no real pathway for the evacuation of these troops that the Ukrainian general staff were talking about. So anyway, there it is. Pokrovsk, Mirnograd, we've taken another step over the last 24 hours, a significant step towards the end. Now, I will say that I've come to the view that the Russian Defense Ministry is not going to announce the fall of Pokrovsk until Mirnograd falls. They will only confirm that they're in full control of Pokrovsk when the entire Pokrovsk conurbation is under their control. This is what they recently did in Toretsk, and it looks to me as if this is what they're going to do in this battle also. Now, in other places, everything continues to go wrong. We've had a whole cluster of Russian comments. Our old friend Marochko talked about the situation in Liman. He said, according to information available to me, our troops have advanced considerably near Liman over the past few days, approximately by 1 kilometer in the southern direction. They have begun to take positions on forest terrain and mop up territory both north and east of Liman. And he says that while the Ukrainians are putting up a fierce resistance and still hold a large territory southwest and south of Liman, the settlement of Vilcha also makes some adjustments to operations, but our forces continue their advance. So that's Marochko about the situation there. There's lots of reports about the situation in Siversk, about the Russians capturing more fortified positions east and south of Siversk. And this is what Marochko had to say about this. He said that regarding the settlement of Siversk, the Ukrainian group there is trapped in a fire pocket near Zvanovka. This is a village to the south of Siversk, and is being systematically destroyed. Our troops are slowly but steadily tightening their grip on the cauldron on a regular basis. So notice that Marochko is now talking about a cauldron in Siversk as well. And, well, in Konstantinovka too, there are rumours that the Russians are preparing some major attack also. So, a very bad situation for Ukraine, to put it mildly, and one which continues to get worse. Dmitry Medvedev, the deputy chair of Russia's Security Council and the head of Russia's Military Industrial Commission, had this to say about the general situation. The encirclement of Ukrainian troops can potentially bring down the whole front line and might cause new territorial losses. In the energy industry, the breakdown caused by Russian strikes is going stronger. So far, the lights are still on, but there are interruptions. The heating situation is bad. The Ukrainian leadership in Kiev has predictably found itself in a Zugzwang. Every day is bringing it into a worse position on the chessboard. And Medvedev couldn't resist the temptation to talk about the scandal in Kiev. He said that the corruption channel involving Timur Mindich, widely known as Zelensky's wallet, has been noticed even in Europe, and that the Europeans are becoming reluctant to perish alongside the proliferating campaign mold defending Kiev. And, well, he used all the usual language that he often resorts to in describing the governments in Europe and in Ukraine. Well, one can perhaps leave aside Medvedev's comments about the situation in Kiev, the corruption crisis in Kiev, which I've discussed extensively in my recent programmes, but about the fact that Ukraine is in a Zugzwang, I think he is right. Whatever the Ukrainians now do on the battlefronts, whatever rearrangements take place in Kiev, every Ukrainian act is going to make the overall situation worse. If the Ukrainians, for example, try to stem the Russian advance towards Pavlograd, they will be obliged to take troops from other places, already tired and exhausted troops from other places, which will accelerate the Russian advance in those places. I've already discussed how sending Ukraine more Patriot missile systems not only is not going to change the situation, but is essentially throwing those Patriot missile systems uselessly onto a bonfire. It's not just Ukraine that is in Zugzwang. It is the West in terms of the conflict in Ukraine as well. But no one for the moment seems interested in doing anything. The European Commission is still trying to get European governments to agree to its plan to provide Ukraine with a 140 billion euro loan using Russian frozen assets as collateral. Friedrich Merz, as we've seen, is increasing the amount of funding he's providing to Ukraine by 3 billion euros for next year. There are rumours and reports now widely circulating that unless Ukraine urgently receives money, it will run out of money itself in February, at which point, presumably, the reality of bankruptcy will become unavoidable. And as I've said already, we could be looking at a hyperinflation crisis. But advice from people like Michael Flynn to try and extricate from this disaster continue to go unheeded. Western governments, European governments, continue to be committed to the war. And of course, Zelensky shows no sign of altering his views about the need to keep the war going. And as I've said already, I don't think anybody else in the political system in Kiev would take a different policy from the one which he has been taking. So, all the stars are now aligned, and for Ukraine, they are aligned badly. Bankruptcy in February, the lights going out as a result of the Russian air offensive, the energy system collapsing, cold in what is expected to be a very bad winter, and defeat on the front lines. Obviously, it is not the end, but it is very bad, and it brings us closer to the end. Well, anyway, there it is. The Russians watch and wait. President Putin is now busy preparing for his major marathon, his talk program, when people from across Russia ask him questions. We'll see what those questions say, and we'll see what he says. There's continued gloom in Europe, especially about the situation of European industry, increasing complaints about aggressive Chinese competition. Well, Chinese competition is there and it is aggressive, though the Chinese can hardly be faulted for making industrial goods and cars and things of that kind that have actually better quality than the German cars that they are competing against. Talking about this as if what the Chinese have done is somehow horrible and unfair, frankly, strikes me as ridiculous. And I've been reading more and more articles about how Merz's fiscal bazooka, his debt-fueled spending program, is not working and won't work. And I read articles like this in the Financial Times. Merz accused of using debt bazooka for welfare and tax cuts. Two prominent institutes and the Bundesbank sound alarm over use of new borrowing. And then we go on to read, that German Chancellor Friedrich Merz has been accused by economists of channeling billions of euros of new debt intended for defence and infrastructure spending to fund a higher welfare budget and other expenditures. The Bundesbank and two economic think tanks have warned that a sizable portion of the government's planned additional borrowing was likely to be used for areas that should be funded from the ordinary budget. And we then read that the new rules open the door to up to 1 trillion euros of additional investment in these two areas, that's to say infrastructure and defence, over the next decade. The German Economic Institute, which is, by the way, a very prestigious institute in Germany, is the latest to raise concerns, suggesting that at least 40% of planned additional debt by 2029 will be used to plug holes in the ordinary budget. In other words, as Germany goes deeper into recession and demands for welfare inevitably increase, the government is plugging the holes by transferring funding from infrastructure and defence to social security. And the German economics industry said that Merz's coalition was using a whole range of subterfuge to work around rules stipulating that the additional borrowing has to be spent on extra investment in defence and infrastructure. The budgetary shell game risks undermining Germany's future economic competitiveness, said an Economic Institute economist, Tobias Henze. And who can doubt that this is so? Now, for the record, Merz's popularity has now, in 6 months, reached roughly the same position as Keir Starmer's. The collapse of Merz's popularity is astonishing. It is meteoric. And, of course, the fact that Germany is actually in recession, a recession which his fiscal bazooka is to some extent concealing, well, that plays the key role in explaining this collapse. Of course, he's not the only leader in serious trouble. Here in Britain, I've spoken for several days in succession now about Keir Starmer's rapidly shrinking prospects. The mood on the financial markets relative to the situation in Britain is very bad. And the Labour Party, people within the governing Labour Party, have now woken up to the reality that Prime Minister Starmer has no plan for the economic well-being or recovery of Britain, and nor does his Chancellor, Finance Minister Rachel Reeves. They are basically making it up from one day to the next. They're crisis managing as everything falls apart around them. Now, as I said, there is a way out of all of this, and I want to reiterate this again. The way out is to talk to the Russians, not lecture them, as the British tried to do recently, when Starmer's national security advisor, Jonathan Powell, called Putin's foreign policy advisor, Yuri Ushakov. I mean, actually engaging the Russians in proper, detailed discussions about the situation in Ukraine, looking for a realistic way out of this crisis, in a way that would result in sanctions being lifted and the oil and gas from Russia, so necessary to restore Europe's competitiveness, to reduce energy and electricity costs, improving the straitened position of families and assisting businesses to get this finally done. But if you can find a single official in the British, German, French, Italian, or Spanish governments who is proposing this, apart sporadically perhaps from Matteo Salvini in Italy, well, please tell me about this person, because I haven't seen them. I haven't seen them say anything about that myself. It's not just a case of Europe putting its foot down on the accelerator as the car drives towards the cliff. It's of the driver, the governments of Europe, shutting their eyes as the cliff approaches, telling themselves all is well and Ukraine is successfully holding its own and even fighting back. I've never known, I've said this many times, but I'm going to say it one further time. I have never known in all the history of Europe anything quite like this. The German Chancellor during the Second World War, the one who ended up in a bunker under Berlin as the Red Army closed in around him, had in some respects at least a better grip on reality than the people who are in charge of things in Europe now. Or so at least it seems to me. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.